mouse will devour you.
Episode 3, Death in the Valley.
Kilfaughn Hall, 8th of November, 1925. My dearest Elizabeth, I have much to tell you. I have had a most disagreeable experience today, and together with the general strangeness of this house, it may be just as well that you have been delayed, even if I do miss you so. I am also having the most uncanny and vivid dreams. They fade quickly as dreams do upon waking, apart from a lingering sense of fear and dread. Your brother told me when I arrived that he was surprised that the hall had not been burnt to the ground, like so many of the big houses in these parts, and he hoped to point it to a remaining fondness for the Sanderson family name, your father having been a regular visitor to these parts. From my experiences today, I fear he is misguided in this belief and needs to remain alert for any mischief. This morning, George and I, accompanied by several ground staff, went down to the market square in Kilfaughn village to assist in the search for the missing boy. It was a dank morning, with a persistent drizzle that pattered noisily on our oilskins. In the thin light, buildings around us loomed blankly, dark wet streaks disfiguring them. There were 20 of us men huddled in the windswept square, and a short shopkeeper type with the air of a martinet divided us into 5 groups that would be dropped off at intervals along the river. I marvelled at his assumed authority, though it wasn't long before I realised whence it likely came. I found myself in a group with our house steward, Mr. Murphy, and 2 young lads. Even exaggerated by the bulky coats we wore, I'd not appreciated before just how big a brute of a man Murphy was. By contrast, our 2 comrades, Micheál and Porrig, were whip-thin with pinched features. While I was sorry to be in the same group as Murphy, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't relieved not to be in the group with the missing boy's father, unlike poor George. We were given a whistle to blow if we found anything, and then a lorry dropped us off at a stone marker out of town. We clambered down to the banks of the River Blackwater. I've long heard that the Blackwater Valley is a most scenic and beautiful place. Indeed, you attested as much in your letter. But to be honest, scrabbling in the bushes by the deep, fast-moving water, poking at the edges with my stick while trying not to fall in, hoping to find something and dreading to find it, it wasn't the best way to take in the view. The wind funneled down the river valley, driving the rain before it. The southern slope gives way to fields, farms and estates, and ultimately to the sea. The northern side we were on is steeper and wooded, and gives way again to high fields and eventually to the remote slopes of the Knockmealdown Mountains. Along the northern slope are nestled many great houses, their southerly aspect allowing the gentry here to indulge their passion for gardening to the full. Kilfaughn Hall is one of those houses, though it sits at a kink in the valley and faces west. No gardening today, though. Only madmen like us were out in this rain that somehow managed to trickle its way in, despite my oilskins. After an hour of poking at the water's edge and prodding bushes for their secrets, and indeed several near misses on the slippery bank, Murphy called a halt for a smoke break by a stand of trees. The other 2 deferred to him, and he'd assumed leadership of our little group. I didn't care. I was well aware I was a newcomer here. There was an intense silence for a while as we struggled to roll and light cigarettes, or in my case, my pipe. Every so often a gust of wind would check heavy drops from the trees that would fall noisily on us and the leaves around. Murphy had pulled back the hood of his fisherman's jacket. His white hair was dishevelled and stuck out at angles as he drew sharply on a cigarette. We puffed away in quiet camaraderie for a few minutes, or so I thought, until Micheál spoke.
"Are ye married to his lordship's sister then, sir?" he asked.
I was surprised at the question, but I thought to ingratiate myself with them, for George's sake. "Not yet," I said. "We are engaged."
"Sure, good Irish man and a fancy man like yourself. I'd have thought there'd be Irish girls falling all over you."
I looked sharply at him, surprised by the familiarity of his tone and the sneer underneath it. I didn't miss either the quick glance he gave to Murphy before he continued.
"And where are ye from, sir, if I may be so bold as to ask?"
I sighed. I wasn't sure what this was, but I didn't like it. I was suddenly conscious of being alone with these 3 men that clustered close under the dripping trees, and the stout sticks we all carried. Dublin, I said, not wanting to play this game, or be more specific.
Ah, you're a Jackeen, so. Those traitorous feckers come down every so often to tell us what we can or can't do.
Well, that made one thing clear. These men were on the losing anti-treaty side in the Civil War.
Is that you now? Come down to spy on us?
Did they think I was a special branch man? Before I could give that the answer it deserved, Murphy dropped a cigarette and crushed it into the mud.
Right, he said. Back to it.
I stood there as the three men started off along the riverbank again. I wasn't clear what had just happened, but I was sure it wasn't over yet. We were at it for another hour, and now I was careful in how close I was to the others, alert for what might be coming, and not sure what I could do even when it came. Micheál went in front, Murphy behind him and blocking out the view, then myself with Porrick to the rear. I tried dropping back and letting him past, but he always slowed to stay behind me. I found myself wondering if he might have a gun concealed in his jacket.
We came to a place where the road bent down to meet the river, and a lorry, not the one that had dropped us off, was waiting for us there, pointing back the way we'd come.
There were two men in the cab who nodded to us as Murphy led the way round the back. The rear was wooden-sided with a canvas roof. Gallagher's Butchers was emblazoned on the side in large letters over a picture of a pig. Micheál and Porrick clambered up into the back. Murphy looked at me, his expression unreadable.
Up, he said.
I hesitated, the familiar feeling of impending danger growing louder in me. Murphy stared at me.
Suit yourself. It's a long walk back in this weather.
He reached up with a strong arm and hauled himself in. I looked at the three men inside, sitting still on boxes and sacks. I suddenly doubted myself. Was I reading far too much into this? I find perspective can be difficult sometimes, after the war.
They are probably just trying to wind me up to get me to make a fool of myself.
I sighed and got in.
Porrick, said Murphy, get your arse off that box and let Mr. Ross have a seat.
I would have preferred standing, but I was unsure of myself now. I took the offered seat, and then Micheál slid in too close beside me. Deliberately or not, I was trapped in the corner of the compartment. I ignored Micheál, who was humming a jaunty tune. There were no carcasses in the van, but the floor and walls were stained, and above Murphy's head was a row of empty meat hooks. The way back to town followed the river. Instead, we veered off up a road that rose through the woods of the northern slope. I looked at Murphy, and he stared impassively back. Flurries of heavy raindrops from the trees on either side rattled on the roof. Micheál's annoying humming petered out. We drove on in silence, apart from the labouring of the engine. When we were high on the valley side, the lorry pulled over and came to a halt with a squeal of brakes. The engine cut out, and one of the men in front banged twice on the panel separating us from the cab.
Smoke break, said Murphy, rising and dropping to the ground.
The other two followed. I realised I'd been stupid to get into this vehicle. Now I could only see this thing through. I remember the fuss in Britain a few years ago in the War of Independence, when local forces kidnapped General Lucas while he was fishing on the Blackwater, near Fermoy to the west of here. He had been released after a month of drinking whiskey and playing lawn croquet with his captors. Somehow, my companions did not strike me as a croquet-playing sort. I dropped down to the ground from the lorry, my stick casually in hand. We were up high where the woods give way to fields of grass as the land levels out. Near us was the edge of a rocky crag. I wondered how far the fall from it was. In different circumstances and weather, the view would have been magnificent. The other three stepped close. I heard the two men up front get out, but they stopped short before coming round and joining us. I heard the rasp of a match and smelled cigarette smoke. We lit up also, though my pipe was the last thing I fancied, and we smoked in a charade of friendliness. After a while, Murphy said,
"Lovely view, isn't it? I like to come up here to remind myself what it was we fought for. First against the Brits, and then amongst ourselves."
I waited for him to continue, but instead it was Micheál that spoke next.
"Mr. Murphy tells me you were a captain in the British Army, according to his lordship. Did you know, Captain Ross, There were two types of Irishmen who came back from the war in Europe. Three, if you count the dead. Those who picked up arms when they got home and fought their old paymasters. And those like you, happy to take their army pension, while in the end, Irishmen fought Irishmen. I said nothing. I'd seen more death than any of these men ever would. Why would I want more? Murphy took a deep drag on a cigarette and then straightened up and rolled his shoulders. It only emphasised how big a man he was. Micheál took a step back, out of my line of sight. Right so, Murphy said. I gripped my stick hard and tensed. Then Silent Porrick spoke for the first time. Listen, did you hear that? A look of annoyance flashed over Murphy's face. But he stopped and listened. I could hear it too now. A faint but insistent whistle coming from down in the valley. Well, well, well. It looks like they found something, Murphy said. He flicked a cigarette into the wet grass and looked at me with a cryptic half smile. We're done here, lads, said Murphy. Micheál made to say something, but Murphy cut him off at a glance. And that, Elizabeth, was that. Whatever had been about to happen, its moment had passed. We rode back down in silence to the Blackwater. One of the search teams had found the boy's threadbare jacket. There was a brown stain on the front of it that was not mud. I've probably got you worried now, so let me touch on lighter news. Your great aunt Edith made a point of being seated across from me at dinner last night and grilled me the entire meal on my family, prospects, what I did in the war, where we two had met, and my intentions. She may be a tiny old woman with a glint in her eye and a cigarette permanently on the go, but she would make a great police inspector. I felt positively drained by her questions. The thought of lunching alone with her, as I fear is her intention, the better to isolate me and pry, is more frightening to me than waiting to go over the top ever was. It is a battle I will only lose and will be left a pitiful, eviscerated corpse. Expect some questions from her also via your mother. I found myself a little embarrassed when I asked Aunt Edith after the new tenants of the manse. I was then unable to supply a family name, only a first, and a man's at that. If her eyebrows could have climbed higher, they would have disappeared into her hair. You must, in your next letter, supply me with some particulars on this Roland chap. He sounds interesting, and I'm sure his wife will be a welcome additional conversationalist in your circle. George and I retired, or perhaps escaped, to the smoking room, and made ourselves comfortable in the overstuffed armchairs by the fire. It had been a cold day, and the house's heating is not up to keeping the chill out. We had whiskies, I had my pipe, and George those French cigarettes he affects. We sat in silence for a while, enjoying the drowsy heat of the fire. After ribbing me about the interrogation I'd just endured, it was George who actually brought up the subject of Lily King. Indeed, that may tell you everything you need to know on his thoughts on her. Charles King, the current Lord Clonlaw, and her uncle, has a sizeable estate south on the other side of the Blackwater River. George tells me that Clonlaw House is a large edifice more suited to grander times. Lily arrived during the summer, and it's a stay for the hunting season and Christmas. George is clearly sweet on the girl, and he believes his affections are reciprocated. Well, I suggested they have her and her uncle over for lunch or dinner. At this point, George got hesitant, which is unlike him. But George has had some run-ins with Lord Clonlaw, and therefore was loath to invite him over. A most unpleasant character who seems to have taken against me before he ever met me, was his assessment. The man is also rumoured to be quite unwell. A long-standing illness, apparently. But he also lost both his sons in the war, and according to George's sources, became even stranger than before. As we talked, and George described him in more detail, I realised I had met this man already. Would you believe, the unpleasant fellow I'd seen on the boat, and who had come close to unseating me and injuring my horse, is in fact her uncle, Lord Clonlaw. Well, this was an awkward turn up for the books, as I had fully intended confronting and berating the man for his behaviour. Now, though, I did not want to injure George's chances with Lily. It had occurred to me that his good humour these days may be more to do with her attentions, and not the restoration of Kilfone Hall, as I originally thought. The upshot is neither George or Lily care to be dictated to by an angry old man,
and Lily will be lunching at Kilfone Hall later this week. It was rather obvious that George wanted her introduced to Aunt Edith, so that ordeal could be gotten out of the way. Anything that divides her forces is fine by me. I tried speaking to George of my concerns about Murphy, but he didn't listen, as he thinks highly of the man and the quality of his work. Admittedly, I have no proof of anything but my fears. I wonder, though, what is going on in this valley. As we stood there in the rain, examining the boy's jacket, I had looked up at the northern slope. There, against the skyline, was Kilfone Hall. I wish you were here, Elizabeth, to distract and warm me with your kind and sensible nature. Yours lovingly, John.
The Interloper.
Clatbury, Wilts, 12th November, 1925. My dear John, it was a joy to receive your letter on such a dank, dark day as it is here, though I was distressed to sense that those dark moods that have beset you since the war are still active, albeit triggered by being put in such an alarming situation out in the hills. John, I do hope you are taking adequate care in what to you these days is really a foreign land. Those chaps from the butchers that behaved threateningly toward you while you were engaged on a good deed sound thoroughly dishonourable individuals, and I would steer well clear if I were you. I felt it behoved me, yesterday being the armistice, to attend the local ceremony. It was a very minor event in a village as small as ours, though Clatbury did lose a number of men in the conflict, farmhands mostly, and their loss is still keenly felt. As you know, we did not move here until a few years ago, during the recent upset in Ireland, so I did not know any of the fallen personally. But it seemed fitting to join the village in mourning their glorious dead. It was a cold morning, and although I was wearing my grey woollen coat and burgundy cloche hat, I had no scarf or gloves, and I felt the keen air around my throat as I stuffed my hands, I hope not too disrespectfully, into my pockets. Mother didn't wish me to attend, but I made an excuse about running an errand to post letters to you, and left ere she had the chance to protest unduly. However, Dr. Mondrell did see me at the memorial, and made some sardonic remark about no point respecting the glorious dead if it meant I would soon become one of their number. I played it down at the time, but it is now leaving me unnerved. Perhaps he thinks my ailment is more serious than he makes out. I returned from the ceremony as quickly as I could, and have remained indoors ever since, enjoying boiled eggs, buttered toast, and plenty of hot tea by the fireside. However, I did receive a visitor in the form of Roland, who yesterday had been to market day in Marlford, and ended up seeing a newsreel in which he recounted a disturbance at the Armistice Day ceremony in Dublin. Smoke bombs were thrown amid general disorder. Roland warned me strongly against travelling to Ireland at this point, and made very disparaging remarks about the state of the place and its people, to which I once again forbore to respond. He must know of our family's long-standing connections to Ireland, but he prefers not to inquire of it. He had, however, visited a chemist in Marlford to obtain the required solutions for developing his camera film of the bonfire, and has invited me into his darkroom to assist in the procedure. I must confess I am very excited to witness this process, and would love to accept. But I fear the chemicals may be harsh and volatile and aggravate my chest condition. Roland was dismissive of this, but has suggested I may be better off with some new sunray treatment available in London. It would be good to know your views on this matter. Interestingly, I found out why Roland has leased the manse by himself. He is an archaeologist and is anxious to spend time in the Wiltshire Downs to study some of the ancient features of the landscape. The better to understand the pre-Christian souls who dwelt there and constructed the earthworks. Mother thinks it is a blasphemy to disturb these long-dormant sites, but I am curious about these people and their ancient civilizations. After all, without study and evidence, how can we ever learn? That is why Roland also embraces photography, so he can document the sites he visits and the general landscape. But I do think he needs to be aware that there can be an animus hanging about such places many centuries on. Take good care of yourself, my darling John, and write soon. Your loving fiancée, Elizabeth. If you have enjoyed what you've just listened to, please subscribe, review, or share to help us flourish.